This is the Hidden Why Podcast, episode 542, with Paul Dolan. He is the author of Happiness by Design, finding pleasure and purpose in everyday life. Enjoy the show. G'day, crew. How the heck are you? I hope you're well. Lee Martinuzzi here, the host of the show. Welcome to this week's episode, my interview with Paul Dolan. So Paul is the author of a book called Happiness by Design, finding pleasure and purpose in everyday life. Paul is a professor of behavioral science, and he uses the latest cutting-edge research to reveal that well-being isn't all about how we think. It's about what we do. By making deliberate choices that bring us both pleasure and meaning, we can redesign our lives for maximum happiness without thinking too hard about it. That's what his work hopes to address and hopes to assist others in achieving. You can read his full bio at the website, thehiddenwhy.com. I've got it in the show notes there. Guys, it's a really cool conversation. It is a short one. Usually they go for about an hour, don't they? But today, Paul had a limited amount of time, so we talked for about 30 minutes. We don't ask all the typical questions that I ask guests for the first time on the show. We just delve straight into conversation. So we talk about how people feel and why that's so important, defining fear, misery, and happiness, and how pleasure and purpose can help us achieve a greater state of happiness. We talk about, you know, the emotional state of our being that is contagious, in particular how misery can be contagious to others. And we also share, or Paul shares, some techniques and practices to help us get on the path towards greater happiness as well. Enjoy the show, guys. Let me know what you think. We'll chat at the other end. Thank you. G'day, Paul. Welcome to the Hidden Why Podcast. How are you going?
Yeah, fine, thank you, mate. How are you?
All the way from UK. Mate, really, really good. Thank you.
Good. I know. Well, it's nice that we both use the word mate.
That's good, isn't it? That's a connection already. So talk to me, Paul. What's it's morning over there. Have you got up and you've done your morning routine? Do you have a morning routine?
Well, I get out of bed.
That's always a good thing.
I used to like go to bed late, but then you have children and you can't do that anymore. So okay. I'm up nice and early in the morning. It's 10 a.m. So I've been up half a day.
Oh, okay. And what do you what's your morning routine look like? You got any structure to that, or just go with the flow?
No, it's nice. One of the great privileges of this job is that actually no 2 days are the same. So, other than being up early, the rest of what follows is changes on a day to day basis.
Okay, so what do you actually do, just for the audience?
What do I do? Yeah, exactly. That's a really good question. So I am an academic at the London School of Economics and Political Science here in London. Hmm. Trained as an economist, more into a psychologist over the last decade or so.
Wow.
Do research and teaching into human behaviour and happiness.
So your primary sort of interest now is around human behaviour and science, I guess, and happiness. Why happiness? What's the connection there?
So, well, I started out as a health economist actually, and I was trying to value the impact of health conditions and health states on people's lives so that they could be used to inform policy decisions in healthcare. And I realized that some of the measures that we were using in that space were not particularly useful. So I just was drawn more directly to how you could measure the impact of health states and other things in people's lives by asking them directly how they feel. So that kind of led me into happiness research through more of a public policy angle.
Okay. And what do you see as the effects happiness has, or lack of happiness maybe, has in a society?
Do you want to be a bit clear in that question? I think there's a lot of segues into that. I think you might have a more specific question in mind, or not.
No. it's kind of broad, I guess. Apologies for that. But as far as happiness goes with the individual, how does the cumulative effect of that across the society have impact in an economical sense, I suppose?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. My major research interest, I suppose, is really in looking at the things that cause happiness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happiness is most affected by in terms of the conditions and circumstances of people's lives, particularly activities that they engage in, the thoughts and feelings that they have as they go about their lives. But actually also, of course, happiness is really significant and important in determining other outcomes of interest. So we know, for example, from good evidence, actually good randomized controlled trials, causal evidence that happier people are, they're more pro-social, they're healthier, they're more productive at work. I actually, when I first came to happiness data, I thought there'd be something in misery. And that there are specific contexts, perhaps, where, you know, not being, you know, jumping for joy might be helpful for you. But actually, most of the time, happiness is good for individuals and it's good for the social impact that that happiness has. So I think that would be
a fairly good reason to research happiness. Looking at what determines happiness, how one goes about being happy, because, you know, if they're not, then that has a subsequent effect on society, obviously their well-being, but society as a whole.
Yeah, and also, of course, as we all know, misery loves company, right? So if you're miserable, then you make those around you miserable too. So it's like a contagious disease.
I think that's so like what anything, like any mood or emotion can be very contagious, can't it?
Exactly. And so, you know, not only should we care about our happiness for ourselves, we should care about it for the impact having on other people.
Yeah, absolutely. So with misery, just going to that for a second, how do you define misery, that term?
Yeah, so for me, everything is in how people feel, and it's in how people feel moment to moment, day to day. So that's actually in contrast to how we have most often measured happiness, which is to ask people very global, evaluative questions, like overall, how satisfied are you with your life these days? You know, there is some use to those questions and answers.
Sorry, just to interrupt there, would we ask, you know, how happy or how satisfied are you with a particular category of your life, like your relationships, your work?
What I recommend we do, and we get into some of the details about how I would distinguish between different ways of answering these questions, but I would just simply ask people how they feel, right? How are you feeling now, right? So I think you've got reasonable access. I mean, there's, you know, the whole problems of responses to questions and the reactivity effects that those generate. But by and large, you've got a good sense of how you're feeling now, right?
That I'm kind of excited because I'm speaking to you, but I'm also a little bit drained because it's 8 o'clock at night and generally I've had a big day. So that's how I feel.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd ask you those questions and they're relatively easy questions to ask, to both ask and answer. And then what I'd do is I'd find out all sorts of other stuff about you, right? Hmm. I'd find out how you use your time. I'd find out your income, your marital status, your education level, your employment, all the things that I could possibly find out about you. And then I would run a regression model. I get lots of data from lots of people. And then I'd run a estimation model that basically tries to predict the impact of all of those things, the marriage and the income and the education and the employment, on your happiness.
Okay,
that's how I would establish the things that make you happy and miserable as you go about your life.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you'd ask people how they feel, and that's, I guess, in doing some research, that would be how they feel at that particular time of their life, not in the particular moment, but more sort of a generic, you know.
I distinguish between pleasure and purpose in the book, subtitled Happiness by.
I like that.
In everyday life, so I think there's two sets of experiences that we're having, and you know, you and I are having those experiences now. This is you know, kind of a bit of fun, but it also feels quite purposeful, meaningful.
Yeah.
So there are probably other things that we could be doing right now that would bring us more pleasure, but this makes us feel purposeful. So I would ask more direct experience based questions about activities like what we're doing now. So maybe immediately after it's finished. Mm-hmm. So the memory of the experience is very salient. I would ask you how much pleasure and purpose you experienced in this conversation. Mm-hmm. And then I do that on you regularly and lots of other people over a longer time frame as possible.
Yeah.
And then that would enable me to establish what things you do in your life bring you pleasure and purpose, and equally which things you find, painful and purposeless.
Okay. So we're really looking at how people feel and then going deeper than that to see how they operate in day-to-day life, so all the things that they might be doing. And then would you assess those individual activities as far as the pleasure and purpose of those activities? Is that what I'm understanding?
Exactly. So, and I just wanted to, again, draw a contrast to how we've typically thought about happiness in measurement and for use in policy is that we tend to look at these big evaluative questions and then correlate them with the circumstances of people's lives, which really matter. But there was a book, it was actually, you know, quite a well-known book published a while ago now called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, which is actually basically, you know, don't worry about day-to-day things. But actually, what I'm asking us to do is pay attention to the small stuff. It's actually sweat the small stuff and don't sweat the big stuff.
Right?
So what you do day-to-day, you know, with your scarcest resource of all, your time, is really, you know, really matters. And that's what really affects how you feel, because that's what you pay attention to, right? All the people that make you feel good and bad, commuting to and from work that, you know, often makes you feel miserable, time spent with your boss, time spent hanging out with friends, time spent sleeping or listening to music, all, you know, things that, and also, of course, what a lot of your time is spent doing is ruminating and thinking about things that have happened or are yet to happen. And that distracts you from paying attention to things in the moment. So I'm really interested in that more granular kind of local happiness, if you like.
Yeah. So a couple of questions there, and certainly the small stuff, you know, for me seems to add up, and it seems like, and this is just my assumption and perspective, but we have more and more of that small stuff that is encroaching our lives and certainly having impact on our state of happiness. Because, you know, there just seems to be more that we do. We seem that nothing is enough. So we seem to want to take on everything. And the other one that comes back just to mind is, again, that misery. You know, is that misery and miserable? I mean, is that the opposite of happiness? Is that how we're sort of looking at that state at the moment?
Yeah, so I'd ideally be asking people questions about the anxiety or the stress or the worry or the sadness associated with those activities that they engage in regularly. But also importantly, because I think purpose is so important as an experience, I'd also be asking the questions about the extent to which those activities feel like they're a waste of time, right? A lot of time that people spend at work, there's actually nothing worse than feeling like you're wasting your time.
No, I hate it.
that's where a lot of misery shows up.
Do you think everyone's the same with that? Because it's for me, I'm just, yeah, it sort of defines my life and it makes me quite impatient, actually, which I have to try and balance out. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. I mean, there's clearly going to be individual variation. And I think one of the things I try not to do in the book is to try to prescribe a one-size-fits-all approach to life. Because I think too many of the self-help genres, like, you know, do this. And it's like, well, actually, that's not for me.
Yeah, well, recently they said if it all worked, if all the how-tos worked, then we'd all be rich, successful, and happy.
Exactly. And also, of course, what they do is they kind of give you these often quite glib pieces of advice and no tools to implement them.
Yeah, yeah.
So you then rated and made more miserable, which then means you go out and buy another self-help book. So there's a nice self-fulfilling sales prophecy there that comes from the lack of success of self-help books.
So with misery, I heard this recently that, you know, misery is more associated with how things haven't been, so more associated with the past and being caught up in that sort of mindset, whereas the feeling of fear is more caught up with, you know, what we expect of the future and how we fear it not, you know, panning out as we wish, perhaps. Can you sort of expand on that or correct me or, yeah, give us your thoughts?
I mean, there clearly are individual variations. So a lot of people will. I mean, I've never really been one to ruminate on things that have happened, right? I mean, I might worry about things that are yet to happen, but I never really dwell on anything that has happened in the past. But clearly, that's not everybody, and a lot of people do that. And if you're doing that a lot, in fact, if you're thinking about anything a lot, even if it's something good, right? That's probably some problematic relationship you have with that, you know, thought. We don't want to be thinking about too much too often, right? So actually, I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, when you're laying in bed awake at 3 a.m, you're not actually really thinking about anything that's happened, you know, that you have to worry about right now. It's things that have happened in the past that you can't change, and things that are going to happen in the future. That are never going to pan out quite. I mean, you know, I fall into these traps as much as everyone else. I mean, the number of times that things don't turn out as badly as I spent all that time worrying about them. that they might.
Yeah, I can relate to that, and certainly for me personally, the past is not so much a thing that I think about. It is more about the future, and that's where probably the fear in my life. And I just made this realization the other day. And I thought, okay, well that's quite real, and I sort of didn't feel I lived with fear, but in reflecting, I thought perhaps that is what this is, this feeling. So it's interesting to reflect on that difference between, you know, the past and the future, and whether it's misery and fear. But as it relates to the pleasure or displeasure of the current activity that we're doing, you sort of talk about misery in that sense, yeah? So like if we're catching a train to work, is that experience miserable? Is that causing us a level of unease or misery?
Yeah, and the problem, the problem with there's a compounding issue is that we're not particularly good at predicting when we make our decisions in life, big and small, which thing is going to cause us misery in the experience, right? So when you're choosing between two jobs, for example, the most obvious and salient dimension in which to make the choice is salary. And actually people expect you to do that, right? So if you, it'd be a bit weird if you took the lower paying job, right? You'd have to explain to everybody why you did that.
Yeah, so here's one job, 100K a year, and here's another one, 50K. Okay, I'll take the 50K. Yeah.
If people would look at you like you've gone mad. But actually if the higher paying job is one that involves a longer commute or a more stressful commute where there's uncertainty around how long it's going to take you to get to work, then that's very attention seeking. Day to day, moment to moment, and you don't kind of ever get used to that, you know, especially if you travel on a train or a bus where it could take anything between, you know, 20 minutes and 2 hours. You're constantly paying attention to the fact that you're late, or you might be late, and that sort of plays on your mind every day in a way that extra bit of cash, you know, doesn't really show up.
Yeah. Okay, so something that's more repetitive in nature. That causes, I sort of use the term suffering, but causes some level of suffering in our experience. Maybe more thought of and therefore more a sufferable experience than one that is not quite on hand at moment to moment throughout our life.
Exactly. And so, because a lot of my research has been interested in the mistakes people make, you know, about the predictions about things that make them happy. When they're making a decision and choosing between two options, what matters when they're making that decision, what they're paying attention to in that choice, is rarely the thing that they pay attention to in the experience once the decision is made. And that's what gets us into trouble. That's how we end up making mistakes. So we end up taking jobs or partners or houses or whatever that kind of end up making us miserable compared to an alternative that would have made us happier.
Happier, yeah, that makes sense. Look, I know we've got about 10 minutes left, so for the audience, Paul's quite a busy man, so we've only got the half an hour time slot today. So, Paul, I want to sort of wrap up this conversation, perhaps with some guidance from you, because we've just talked about, you know, living with more happiness. How do you suggest, without putting a template down that can be used for everyone, for us all to sort of maybe understand and reflect on and even use in our own lives to seek greater happiness?
Yeah, I'm going to say something really obvious now, because this is really, most of these insights are actually really obvious, but they're just overlooked. And that is the sort of behavioral science 101 lesson is, if you want to do something, make it easy. And if you don't want to do something, make it hard. And yet, actually, we often make it both in as individuals and in corporations and in policymaking. We make it very hard for people to do things that make them happy, and very easy for them to do things that wouldn't. So the really simple and basic insight to start with is: if you want to do something, make it easy. So if you want to do more of an activity, you want to drink more, you want to drink less, you want to exercise more, you want to exercise less. Normally, exercise more. Is that you design your environment. That's hence really the title of the book, Happiness by Design. You organize your life, your day, in ways that make it easy for you to exercise more. You don't just have an intention that says, "I'm going to start exercising." Well, actually, you can say that a lot if you like, but your past behaviors will speak to your future behaviors much more than intentions do. So what you need to do is think about how you can organize your life in ways that make it easier. So, you know, there's all good evidence on this now, good research evidence. And actually, most of it's really obvious, right? You are more likely to stick at an exercise plan if you do it with someone else, right? Yeah. So find yourself a gym buddy. you're more likely to do it if you have cues and activation in your environment. So put a screen to put on your computer or phone screensaver, a picture of you exercising. You're more likely to do it if you make a public promise, right? So post on Facebook or Twitter or wherever that you're going to go to the gym every day for the next week, right? Make it very small bite sizes and discrete chunks. That's the really important thing. All of these things make it easier that you're going to for you to implement your intentions.
Okay.
It make it easier for you to do things on that day-to-day basis. And then once you've been doing something, and you need to stick at it, right? That's the really important thing, because a lot of people just, you know.
Is it 21 days, or is there a...
Yeah, by about now, pretty much everyone's New Year's resolutions are long gone, right?
Yeah,
but what people do is to, you need to, in some of the health behavior literature, it suggests it takes a couple of months to embed a health habit. So you need to stick at it for those 8 to 10 weeks in order for it to then become habitual. Because what your brain's trying to do, it wants to, it's, you know, basically lazy, and it wants to create habit loops.
Yeah.
So it gets to associations, and you then start acting automatically. But it takes a while for that to embed. You need to kind of stick with it whilst that process is taking place.
Yeah, especially if the old behaviours that we're so used to were more embedded, it's going to take even longer, right? So the whole idea of 21 days to break habits is a little bit of a myth, in my opinion.
It is a myth. I don't think there's any evidence to support that it would happen that quickly.
No. I think it's a good way to experiment with something, to see if it's something that you want to be doing or not. But other than that, I don't think it's going to change your patterns. Permanently, again, depending on what you're sort of seeking to change and adjust.
Exactly, and I think that's important, because you don't want to be, a lot of people will think they need to change things because that's what they're expected to do, right? The number of journalists that I've spoken to said they're going to write a novel because that's what they're expected to say, but they're never going to do it. And actually, it's questionable whether it would make them happy if they did.
Yeah.
So you need to, first of all, decide, design, do, the three bits in part two of the book. You need to, first of all, decide what things, you know, you could be confident would make you happier if you were to design your environment in ways that made it easier for you to do them.
Okay.
But that decide stage is actually critical, because a lot of time we make a mistake there before we even start doing the design and do.
Well, I think we've perhaps got to do that. Is that right? Like, because it's so hard to go, well, I want to do this, because we're so influenced by our surroundings, upbringing, environments, conditioning, whatever. And so we go, okay, well, I want to do this. This seems like something that I, you know, generally would find pleasure in or joy. And then once started, we might go, oh, geez, no, this is not what I want to do at all. So, you know, part of that deciding stage is that trialing stage and experimentation stage too. Is that fair?
It's it. Also, just some things about, you know, breaking free of narratives. I mean, I've got more abuse for saying in Happiness by Design and in passing in a couple of talks and pieces of writing that I don't read novels. And my God, you would think that I've said, you know, it's the most heinous crime for an academic at the LSE not to read fiction. I mean, I read I read lots of books. I read tons of books, but I don't read novels. And yet, the judgment that's made of me by some people, you'd think, I mean, honestly, you'd think I was a serial killer.
So you read fiction, but you read non-fiction, but not fiction.
Exactly. There's only so many hours in the day, right? I haven't got time.
Yeah, I'm not exactly the same. And I've had that question asked to me too, which is quite interesting. So deciding on what we should be doing, what sort of advice do you have there?
Well, as I say, I mean, sometimes you don't know, right? Because you ideally want the feedback of how this makes you feel. And of course, if you're going to do something, you might not have the feedback. But what you could do is you could try to look at the experiences of people who are like you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think one way to find out, you know, whether an experience is going to be enjoyable or not is to ask people like you who've had the experience.
Hmm.
So there's a nice study that shows that women's predictions of how much they're going to like a date are better. That the experiences of other women predict their experiences much better than their own forecast do.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
So there's lots of things where we kind of think that we're clever and we can trust our judgment, but actually we're better advised to listen to other people who have had the same who've had the experience that we've not yet had.
Okay, yeah, I actually had this one interview with a lady a while back now, and I remember she said that she used to do a particular kind of sport, and it was years and years she did it for until she realised that she never actually enjoyed it, and she was just doing it because that's what everyone else around her was doing, and she thought that's what she needed to do to fit in.
Exactly.
So really looking at the activities, deciding on what activities you want to do, go out there, experiment them, I guess, you know, not holding yourself judgingly if you don't like it and giving up to pursue something else with more purpose and value to your life, and then designing your life around that so you can do it with greater ease, and then obviously doing it. So that sounds like a pretty logical process.
There you go. Exactly. And there are, you know, there are a couple of things that I would actually make prescriptive. I'm trying to shy away from this one size fits all approach to happiness, but I reckon, you know, I'm pretty confident that if everybody listened to music that they enjoy for 5 minutes more every day, that we'd all be happier, right? Mm. I mean, there's such good evidence on music and music therapy, you know, activating parts of the brain that no other stimulus can touch.
Mm.
So the question is, well, that's really obvious, right? As I said before, it's really obvious that we should do that, but why don't we?
Mm.
And it's because we don't make it easy for ourselves to do that. We don't remind ourselves that we ought to be doing that. I bought some new headphones at Christmas for my commute to remind myself that I'm going to listen to more music, and it's, you know, so far it's working.
Oh, good.
So it's kind of things.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly some universal things out there, isn't there? I sort of believe in, you know, self-reflection and time for yourself is like meditation, mindfulness. That seems to be a global thing that everyone can benefit from.
Yeah, and the way that you can do that, even if it's not through sort of more formal, structured meditation or mindfulness, is to, you know, not keep checking your emails. I've also taken Outlook off my phone, so I can't check my work emails now. For a week, I mean, I feel liberated because before it was just automated. I just, you know, check my phone, check my emails.
Yeah, every chance I get.
Now I actively have to log on, and it makes me more mindful of my experiences because I'm not being distracted by, you know, checking emails. So there are really simple things. Simple things can have big effects.
Okay, it sounds like an interesting read. I'm going to stick the book in the show notes for all the audience to get. The last one that I sort of want to touch on just before I let you go is, that's really helped me anyway, is really by just removing all the clutter and really simplifying what I do in my life. So just saying, I like to do this, I like to do this, and I like to do this, and that's pretty much all I want to do, rather than trying, you know, to do all the unnecessary stuff, like, you know, checking your emails every single day. You know, just that simplification of my life has really benefited me. It's sort of along the line of the minimalist approach. Have you got any final thoughts on that point?
Yeah, no, I do think, I mean, it is keep it simple, isn't it? I mean, I think we do feel like we need to be cramming so much in our busy and hectic lives, and we want to tell everyone that we're really busy, right?
Yeah,
telling people that we've got no time and we only sleep 4 hours a night, you know, and it's always like a, you know, kind of a macho status of success in some sense. Yeah, it's actually making us miserable because we don't actually do anything properly.
Yeah, so, well, I think if you're not sleeping, then you're going to have there's going to be side effects to that. And like, everyone's different in that sense again as well. But yeah, certainly I notice if I sleep 7 hours a night, it catches up to me pretty quick.
Yeah, cool.
Mate, it's been a pleasure. Cool. I know you've got to go, so thank you. We'll stick the book in the show notes. And if the audience wants to connect, how can they best connect with you?
They can just the simplest way is just to go to pauldolan.co. Is it pauldolan.co.uk? Yeah.
Yeah, I got that.
That's the simplest way. There I am. Brilliant. Cool. Thank you very much.
Let's do a round two sometime. And guys, thanks for listening to the show. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon. There you have it, guys. My short, sharp episode for the week with Paul. What did you think? Did you get anything out of it? Did you learn something? I hope you did. I got a lot out of it. I do with every conversation. I think there's always something that we can learn. So hope you guys are appreciating the conversations here that I'm doing with the guests. If you do, you can always let me know what you think. You can jump on iTunes and leave us a review that way. That does help others assess whether or not it's a show that they want to tune into as well. So do us a favor, jump on there if you haven't already and leave us a review. You can also come on to thehiddenwhy.com, subscribe to thehiddenwhy.com newsletter and the podcast as well. And let me know what you think. You can connect with me. My email address is there. You can connect with me on social media. In particular, I hang out on Facebook, so check out my page there for The Hidden Why as well. Other than that, guys, I have a book coming out later this year, The Ultimate Life Map, so head on over to theultimatelifemap.com. Put your email address in there so you can stay up to date with the release of that. It'll be a cool book, guys, a lot of value there, so I hope you can support me with this journey and with that book in particular. Guys, that's it from me. I hope you're well. Would love to connect with you. Would love to hear your thoughts and anything else, really. If you've got suggestions for the shows, I always like to connect with the people that are listening to the shows. So thank you guys for tuning in. You know what to do. Go out there and breathe more passion into every single moment. Do everything with greater purpose. And in doing so, you will discover your hidden why. My name's Lee Martinuzzi. This is The Hidden Why. Signing out. Cheers. Peace. Passion. Purpose.